Welcome back to WordBalloon.com, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, a conversation with Scott Hines, the host of Fanboy Radio. Before the podcast boom began, Scott Hines got the clever idea to host a comic book talk show at his university's public radio station. We'll talk about Fanboy Radio's beginnings, and I'll take the opportunity to have a real comic book store-style discussion with Scott about the two big publisher events, Civil War and 52.
It's interesting and always awkward when one talk show host talks to another. But in a good way, and you know I'm a fan of your show, and I've been listening for a long time, and in fact, it was your show that inspired my show.
Oh, wow. See, that's huge. Yeah. You said that before. That's so awesome, and that's awesome. I love your show.
Thanks,
and
man.
I love how different the podcasts out there, all the different comic book shows are, and how they're all fulfilling different needs.
Well, how did Fanboy Radio start?
Fanboy Radio started in 2001. It was my second semester at Texas Christian University, and I just switched my major over from history to radio, TV, film.
Okay.
And I was there at the radio station, and I was just one of those kids where they didn't have as many DJs as they could have used. So I basically did every genre I could. I created every show I could. I was just addicted to being on the air. I'm sure you can relate.
Absolutely.
And it was just so much fun. You know, I did pregame shows for the football games. I created a Frank Sinatra show called the Frank and Scott Show, where I actually took audio of Frank Sinatra, and I had it be like me and him. Like, I basically took out the Dean Martins and the all the rest of the Rat Pack and just had me interviewing him and talking to him in between his music. And I basically did all this stuff because the department chairs were big football fans and big Frank Sinatra fans.
There you go.
And so I had to get in good with them.
Giving the people what they want, sure.
Absolutely. So when I felt like I had enough credit, I knew I wanted to do a talk show. And something just for your listeners that probably all of mine don't know, is that I was actually just a huge, huge radio fan. Much more than comic books.
Okay.
Much, much more than comics. I had comics on the side. I had my pull list with about 6 or 7 titles on there. This was right as Joe Quesada was becoming editor-in-chief from being just the editor of Marvel Knights.
Gotcha.
And whenever I got back into comics in college, all I read was Marvel Knights, pretty much just Marvel Knights. And I said, well, things are changing in the comic industry. This is something that I can talk about that most others can't. I couldn't really talk about politics. I have opinions, but that's kind of a huge pool to stick your toe into, you know?
Sure.
And I couldn't talk sports, but I could, I guess, talk about comics. And that's just where it started. And it started off very rough. It started off, we worked on it many times, a pre-recorded 30-minute show, many times over the course of the semester. And by the time the holidays were coming around, on actual Thanksgiving Day, 2001, was our first broadcast. And then we did a new show every other week, just 30 minutes.
Okay. And this was you and TJ back then?
This was me and Josiah.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about Josiah. Sorry, Josiah.
That's okay. He's actually he is a productions director at ESPN Radio in Dallas.
Oh, that's terrific.
So he is definitely moved up.
Good for him.
He's lapped me a few times now in the actual radio business.
There you go.
And he just kind of moved on and up, and that was exactly, you know, it was never his dream to just be a huge to really work on as a talk show host. He just wanted to work in radio, and this was something that he could get started on and add to the demo reel.
Very cool.
So that was awesome. Josiah and I worked together for about 8 months. Our first interview was interviewing comic book fans on campus, and we also talked with just hardcore anime nerds. And just basically just had them debate each other. It's definitely if you've never heard about comics, come on and laugh about comics with us. that was our show at first.
Okay.
Then we said, you know, if we're going to actually describe what comics are to people, let's just go down our list of people that we would love to talk to, down the list of primary sources. If we're going to talk about these comics, why not talk to the actual people? At the same time, we still reviewed comics. We still bitched about comics. Every once in a while, we had movie reviews and video game talk. But we went ahead and sent out a couple emails there, I guess in September and October of 2001, to Joe Quesada, Brian Michael Bendis, Evan Dorkin, the people that we love the absolute most.
Sure.
And pretty much without fail, every single one of them said, yeah, sure, why not?
Very cool.
And it just became, we were overwhelmed by the accessibility of these guys.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
And it's not just that they want to promote their stuff. It's that they are articulate, smart. They want to talk about comics to the unwashed masses. And that's what we wanted to do, too. They were right on board. They knew that we were also going to poke fun at the same time, that we were going to be very tongue-in-cheek, very self-deprecating. And they came right on and kept coming on. There for a while, before the Joe Fridays at Newsarama, Joe came on once a month to give us like a Marvel update.
I remember that.
And there for a while, we thought, you know, hey, if we want to make him live episodes, we need to space him out so that he has big things to talk about, big announcements, and it would be really worthwhile for the callers to call in.
Sure.
So we changed all that. Bendis was on many times, and I mean, we were just kind of stunned at the reaction. This was really right when message boards were getting huge, too.
Right.
So I was definitely part of the message board much more than I am now, I'm sorry to say. Before I even had one, I was doing something very similar to you. I mean, I really understand where you're coming from. I hung out there and post every show information, every link, everything I had from the Bendis board. That was my hangout.
Sure.
And it treated me really, really well. And I was able to continue and grow. We eventually got David Mack on.
Yep.
We got really big into indie comics. I was joined with David Hopkins to create the Indie Show, which is a big hit. He's so busy with professional work now, sometimes hard to organize those. And pre-recorded shows are a bitch to edit and take so much time.
You're telling me.
No kidding. No, I'm preaching to the choir here. So it just became, and also with other, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but with other podcasts out there, I felt like I had to fit more of a niche myself. And that was really the live show. That was the one thing I was, at that point, with the flood of other podcasts coming in, that was the one thing I was offering that was unique.
Absolutely.
Before, I was just kind of the catch-all comic show.
Right.
And then as more shows came up, you know, there's Collected Comics Library, Indie Spinner Rack, you guys, iFanboy, and all of them, many of them, very, very good, and everybody was kind of finding their role. So my role kind of became, all right, well, then I'm going to do live call-in shows, like you say, the Conan O'Brien wackiness self-deprecation, which I love that illusion.
Good, I'm glad you do, man.
I totally eat that up. And
well,
and so other shows have really helped define what I do.
I understand.
And that's been a really good thing. So, right when Josiah left, we had TJ on. TJ was definitely he is a professional quality, great artist, which was really good because I always wanted to be a writer. TJ always wanted to be an artist. It seems just the perfect matchup to talk to comic book creators.
Sure.
He can talk shop with the pencilers and inkers, and I can try and talk shop with the artists. And it worked out really, really good. TJ moved to Houston. He was all over the place, and we had to find somebody else. Right when we were looking for someone else, we started the TV pilot of a TV show called The Fanboy Lounge that we actually produced for the Sci-Fi Channel.
I saw that.
And the trailer's online, and send me an email if you want to get it, no problem, and it's probably all over the message board. But we made it. We were really proud of it, still are very proud of it. Sci-Fi was in love with it. The actual vice president of specialty program greenlit it. He gave us a time slot. And right after that, he left the company. And when he left the company, the new VP of special programming had to clear out his desk completely and said there is a 3 to 5 year wait for all turnover. Okay, well, that's great. and, you know, I'm pulling every favor I can to get that trailer done, you know, to get that pilot done.
Oh, I believe me, I know how tough it is to produce TV as opposed to radio. I know you do.
Night and day, right?
Well, just that much more equipment and manpower to do something where literally you could do this yourself. You have done it yourself, and you know, as far as radio goes.
Oh, sure.
And television, you just need more hands and a lot more equipment and a lot more money to make it look good.
Absolutely. A lot more points of view before you get done to make sure what you're doing is right, because it's not just radio where it's kind of sometimes in one ear, out the other. This has more staying power. More people are willing to look at it and find the mistakes.
Yes.
It's just, you know, apples and oranges. So it's a lot of people do go from radio to TV or radio to acting or other things like that, but I wanted to do it the right way. And I thought we really did. So it was just it's kind of discouraging to find out that wasn't going to happen. Of course, lost almost all contact with almost everybody who worked with me on the project, except for our executive producer, Britta, who became my wife.
Congratulations.
That's, oh, you know.
She's
huge.
Very sweet. I met
best thing that happened from the radio show.
Very cool.
And then the co-host of the TV show, who hadn't been on the radio show, Oliver Tull. I found out about Oliver through the director of the TV pilot, and in order to get our chemistry growing right after we shot the show, because we were sure we were going to keep doing other shows based on the...
the pilot went.
Right. We got Oliver on the radio show. So it just seemed like such a natural fit. As the months went by, Oliver just totally synced. He's an improv comic at 4-Day Weekend in downtown Fort Worth.
Very cool.
He puts on the longest-running stage show in Fort Worth, Texas. I think it's been going on for 10 years straight.
Oh, that's terrific.
Break. He's a true performer. He's a great actor. Incredible guy and a huge fanboy.
Yeah, that's the great thing is he clearly does know his comics. And he's a little older, too, so I think he kind of helps broaden the scope of knowledge, I think, that your show brings.
Absolutely. You know, I know very little about Golden and Silver Age, and he can really fill the need to talk about those things with the people.
Very cool.
I mean, you should have seen his face when we were able to talk with some of the Silver Age guys, and just that is the thing, that is the gift that I can try and give to him to help compensate for him throwing all this work our way, is to have him talk with his idols that
he
grew up with.
You bet. Now, you mentioned Stan, and I know that was a great show, and I think you guys really did a great job with that interview, because it was a great, hardcore, you know, comparing comics today to when Stan was doing it back then. Who are some of the other, you know, big highlights? I know Bendis and Quesada, obviously, but yeah, what are other special guests that really stand out for you?
Well, ones that stand out for me, we talked to Craig Thompson before anybody did.
Yep.
Right after Blankets came out. Really proud of that. It took Wizard Magazine about 7-8 months to follow suit and put Blankets as the, you know, pick of the week or pick of the month or something like that. So I was real proud to talk to Craig Thompson. He actually explained who Raina is in the book and in his real life.
Mm-hmm.
Real interesting answer.
You bet.
Was real proud recently of talking with Garth Ennis.
That was another great show, absolutely.
The man. There's a short list of creators that the guy at my shop has on my pull list by name. And anybody that has a comic coming out that has their name on it, he just throws it into my box. Garth is definitely one of those guys.
I agree with you.
Yeah, as is Bendis, as is Brubaker, God love him. You know, I think that there's a lot of indie guys like Raina Telgemeier, who's just amazing, helped explain what indie comics is, explain what Comics with the X is to our audience. You know, talking with John Romita Jr. and Sr. at the same time was huge.
Yes.
Probably one of my, you know, the time I was geeking out the most. Had a huge time with that. I was a big fan of CrossGen whenever it was actually going on, as funny as it is. And to talk with Mark Wade and Barbara Kiesel when that was going on, it was just a lot of fun. I was really wrapped up in it. Of course, talking with Bill Willingham, Brian K. Vaughan, Mike Oeming. There's a lot of people that I'm just personally really connected to. Dan Slott, James Kolchalka, Steve Niles. I can't stop talking about everybody. The one just last week was Neil Adams that blew my socks off. I didn't expect to. You know, I was kind of nervous because I've heard him talk so many times, and I just know how much smarter he is than I am. And when you come into an interview knowing that, you just want to keep your mouth shut, as a good interview does.
You bet.
And he he just was able to make the hour go by so fast, and we could talk probably for 7-8 hours more.
Oh yeah.
Which, you know, you know all about that. The list can really go on. And then there's the superstars that you love having on for the sheer press of it all, and the Tom Janes and the
Rosario Dawson,
Kevin Smith. Those are the people that you have on that you see slowly starting to bridge the connection of comic books or a pop culture medium as opposed to just a niche culture medium, and the people are getting into it. Brian Posehn and Patton Oswalt.
Yep. Something's
really happening with comics. The fact that all the books are selling out now, and there's a lot of attention, and you know, guys like Hopkins set up shop at San Diego Comic-Con and get bombarded with 15, 16 executive producers going around the con saying, all right, pitch me your show. Pitch me your comic book that I can put in the show.
I got you.
In animation. And that's something that didn't happen to him 2-3 years ago.
Very cool.
So there's a magnifying glass over what we're doing, over what they're doing, excuse me.
No, I understand. What do you think that we do as podcasters and audio interviewers that the magazines or the text-based websites can't do?
Well, we definitely can save the creators time. Because if you're asking them to type up an interview, or if you're having someone be on the phone with them and then typing up their interview, they don't know exactly what's going to be published. They don't have all the options on their hand.
Mm-hmm. You know,
they can't truly express themselves exactly the way they want to, unless it's something like an audio interview. The fact that people are really tuning into podcasts and shows like this is a huge benefit, because they can get an interview with their favorite comic book creator done in an hour, 2 hours, and as opposed to and they can get a lot of work done. Like I said, at the Comics Podcasting Panel in San Diego, which was a ton of fun.
Absolutely.
There's just so many perks to reading an interview. When you read an interview, that's taking up all of your attention. You could be reading a comic in that time. You could be reading their work in that time. While if you're listening to a podcast, you could be running, you could be working out, you could be commuting on the bus,
yes.
You could be surfing on the internet, you could be reading comics, you could be on the crapper, you could be doing anything you want to. Not that you can't read comics on the crapper, because, quite frankly...
Who doesn't?
Exactly.
No, I agree with that. Now, you mentioned that you came back, and I think a lot of us did in that period of, like, 1999, 2000, 2001... You know, when did you start reading comics before then?
Before then, I clearly remember reading comics when my brother was describing what Secret Wars was.
Okay.
When I was like, why the heck is Spider-Man in a black costume? When I could even process that question at 4 years old in 1984, that was what dominated my imagination. And so to have it be the first big event comic, and it to be one of the first comics that I read and understood, and it was written maybe for a four-year-old, it was nothing but exclamations in that thing.
Oh, yeah.
So cheesy, so campy. I love it, but it helped me learn how to read. A lot of those books helped me learn how to read, and there was a ton of comics coming out in the mid-'80s that would teach me. So my dad had a huge love for Spider-Man, and he really introduced the Marvel team-up was Spider-Man and my father to teach Scott how to read. Over the course of many months, it happened, and I was just voracious about it. And so my dad bought the bricks of comics with, DC packs that our comic shops collected, or it came straight from DC. And then I got my first long box. I think when I was 5 or 6.
And
I didn't really spend a ton of money. I think every couple of weeks, every year or so, my dad got me some. But that long box didn't get full until I was a teenager.
Okay.
You know, it was just reading those comics over and over again until they just fell to pieces. And my favorite things to read were the hero and villain profiles. It was just more things to read whenever you had Razorback and the Prowler and a full description of these Marvel heroes. Just having, their power levels, all of their abilities, what they could do, you know, who their allies and enemies are.
Yep.
That's what I really ate up. I think we kind of get over it, indulged with it, with the handbooks and the different types of handbooks and different collections of handbooks now. But at the time, it was the only thing there was. There was just these one, it was the one oversized pamphlet issue that came out every once in a while. And I distinctly remember reading about these obscure D-level characters and just having my imaginations go crazy. And even as a kid, kind of thinking in the back of my head, everybody's done every good Batman story or Superman story, but no one's done the best Razorback story. Now Dan Slott's doing the best Razorback story. So
there you go. Now, what do you think of the whole, playing off of that argument or debate about, you know, comics aren't for kids anymore? Because I was just like you. I was a four-year-old kid learning how to read in the early 70s, you know, with comic books as well. There are concerns that they are too pricey for kids and that there's not enough diverse product for the kid audience, for example. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that whole thing?
Well, I think a lot of people, when we were young, turned to comics to fulfill the need for something for kids, for young kids to read or maturing kids to read. While now we have not only the internet, but all types of publishing are looking more and more like comics. Since computer coloring, since digital coloring has come about, you know, the only thing that was colored way back in the day with the four-color format that had enough illustration to really sedate the ADD-ridden kid was comic books.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have, you know, any bookstore in the children's sections have things that look just like comics.
That's true.
They have, there are things that can fill that need forever. And I'm not talking just manga. I'm not talking about sequential art. I'm talking about prose and illustrations that are blurring the line so closely, they just should wrap a damn word balloon around it and just call it a comic. but they're not doing that, and they don't want to follow the suit. They don't want to be called a comic book. So we have the kids that have fallen in love with the medium growing up and sticking with it. A lot of them aren't, but the ones that have truly identified with either the characters, the storylines, the creators, or the actual craft, the purest version of the craft, they'll stick around and still find comics. And so the next generation of comic kid readers might unfortunately be just second-generation readers in general, just the people whose parents are putting it in front of them like mine were. And when I was a kid, everybody in my school was reading X-Men with Jim Lee,
mm-hmm.
and Spawn, because that was filling a need then. With the internet, MySpace is comics. It's words and pictures that people can get lost in forever. We have an infinite landscape of ways to entertain ourselves. Not the case when we were kids.
Well, I also think that Rucka made a very good point. In fact, I think I heard it on your show, and I've had it with him in conversation as well, where it's not a bad thing necessarily that new comic book readers are entering the scene in their teens. That maybe, you know, that is an interesting new place that they can kind of enter the field and start reading comic books, because,
absolutely.
You know, certainly the material is there and more sophisticated from a writing standpoint and an art standpoint for them to appreciate. And why not play to that and also understand, too, that with the older generations of readers, as the medium has become more sophisticated, you know, that's fine. If anything, it's a cool semi-young adult thing to get into,
right,
rather than a fun kid thing to get into and then mature as we've gotten older.
Right. And DC definitely made that known with Identity Crisis. Whenever they went down that direction, they committed to it being something that really, if you could only understand the concepts of memory wiping and ethics and rape and some serious issues that were going on in Identity Crisis, well, then you could really play the game that Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman are playing. Then you can really dive into all the DC comic books the way they want you to. When they fired that shot, they committed to that. And you're right, it's not a bad thing, because the kids don't have a burning desire to read comics anymore because other places are feeling the need, like I say. But it's just that publishing as a whole has changed, so that now when people are getting their work done in a Word document and you need to give your editor a visual description of what you're doing, you just Google search an image and you just drag it into your Word doc, and so you have comics there in your work that you send off to get published. So it's just not it's not necessary the way it was for David Michelinie and Jim Shooter to provide those for kids. You know, Julie Swartz felt the need to educate kids because kids were reading his work, and he didn't want them to be idiots just talking about who could beat who, so he filled it with trivia. We don't really fill the comics with a lot of trivia, information, education, because there's no pressure from any kind of parent group or the government, you know, any comic code authority by any means, because it doesn't have the attention from the kids, which gives us the freedom to do identity crisis, gives comics the ability to grow up without having to be overseen by any kind of establishment. And that creates true art.
No, I agree with that, and I also think, yeah, I think the medium has reached that point that I think Will Eisner was always hoping for, where television shows aren't only for a certain age group or anything. Television is a medium, books are a medium, comic books are also a medium that can be anything to any age group and any background that you choose to target any type of audience.
That's right.
As it should be.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
What do you think of, now we mentioned Identity Crisis, and I'm glad, because obviously the two, this is good, because I rarely get into fanboy talk on my show, because it is usually just me talking to a creator, and I don't do very much in terms of critiques and stuff, but I've got the fanboy man himself, and I feel this is a good opportunity to talk about some current stories that are going on.
Right on.
Civil War and 52. What do you think of the two big events right now?
Night and day is so different. They're both helping me scratch the different itches perfectly. Love Civil War. I love that I can talk about it, and it will pique the interest of my little nephew, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to talk and without having to talk about politics with them, it's still something that is still somewhat all ages. You know, I think it's still, you know, for the tweens out there, it
sure
can pique their interest. And also old school comic book fans, this is the big battle that has possibly been culminating throughout Marvel Universe history forever. You know, this is the showdown that since Marvel Universe is the Wild West, as opposed to DCU, the established community, that this is something that has been dying to happen forever. And I'm so excited. I'm so pumped up. And the true fan who's got their head on straight and can process the information really won't mind the delay. Really won't.
I agree with that.
You know, won't mind they're delaying a lot of books.
Yes, they are.
And that can affect a lot of things. It's a very big difference than just delaying the one read. You know, that's
sure.
What the people who are willing to actually compare it to Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns, which is silly.
In terms of the delays or in terms of the themes?
In terms of the delays.
Okay.
It's somewhat silly because I mean that's. Let's compare it to those after it's done, first of all, because those are, that's manna from the gods for the comic book craft, those two. I love McNiven. I've loved him since Meridian, you know. I really, really love McNiven since
Absolutely.
Meridian. I've got his huge Meridian poster in my office right now.
Very cool.
But, you know, I don't think it's fair to compare them between the big guns right now for many reasons. One, because it's not done yet. We don't know how truly good it will be as a complete work. Two, it's one series, and they were their own other universe. This is happening in Marvel canon, which is something that they want us to buy into as an ongoing serial forever. This is going to change everything. So they're trying to have us buy stock in the here and now. But when they push back the here and now, then you know that's pretty outrageous. That's pretty serious. So. Very big difference, just delaying the one book and delaying the group of books.
No, I hear what you're saying.
Pretty huge. But it's still good that they did it all, you know? It's still, I'm still happy that they're doing it this way. They're definitely putting the art in front of the pocketbook in this case. Let's hope they do it in every case, you know? I mean,
yeah.
Great they're doing it now, but it's almost kind of rare that they're doing it.
No, you're right about that. And I think... that we've seen examples on both sides of the street, DC and Marvel, where they have kind of said, look, this has to get done. And I understood, as much as I was one of those people that was kind of disappointed with the way Infinite Crisis ended from an art standpoint, they did have to rush it, but I understood why. 52 had to start on time. It is in real time, as you know. And events in 52, the week of the 4th of July, there were fireworks.
Right.
Thanksgiving will be reflected the week of Thanksgiving.
Exactly.
So those things had to be on time. And they didn't want to find themselves in the same trick bag they had during, for instance, Green Lantern Rebirth, where that was delayed, and yet Hal Jordan had already appeared as Green Lantern everywhere else because those books were on time.
Right.
Meanwhile, in Rebirth, you know, we're still waiting for the culmination of him, you know, coming back, in quotes.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, 52, on the other side of the coin, 52 has done a great job with making me want to read it first each week. Actually in the comic shop.
Yes.
So I can talk to the guy who I talk to 52 after I read it every week. It's very, very habitual.
Oh, yeah.
It's very habit-forming for me to want to show up on Wednesday to make sure I get everything and then talk to that same great comic book retailer about what just happened. If it's not that huge earth-shattering event that might happen in Civil War, that's okay. It's going to be one of 52. It's 1/52nd of the actual event of this read. And, you know, if we're going to compare the two to his standpoint, he's much happier to talk about 52 to get everybody into the comic shop every week to
sure.
see what's coming in every week. Because if as huge as Civil War is, and it is absolutely huge for my comic book retailer, he probably, when you compare it all, probably prefers 52 to Civil War, because 52 is coming out 4 times a week, and it's, if you add those up, it's selling more. You know, no one's really adding them up, but it's. I love the weekly format. I love it. I liked it on War Machine.
Me too.
But it's a great thing to have. I don't mind black and white comics at all. And I think if they did something, if everybody, every publisher had a weekly comic, even if it's black and white, if they just kind of just make it gray tones or something, that would be something that really gets people back in there and wanting to read, want to buy their comic, read it then and now, and talk about it. Everything else you kind of want to digest on the commode.
Well, but the difference is, and I'm sure you remember Marvel Superheroes and Action Comics Weekly.
Mm-hmm.
Those were kind of, you know, just 8 pages of separate stories.
Right.
Whereas the one thing I do like about 52 is it is the one story. And also, I think DC, as opposed to Marvel, with the exception of that last issue of Infinite Crisis, which was a rush job, and they acknowledge it themselves, but I think in general, I like the way that they mix artists within a given book, or in the case of 52, that artists are switching up. You know, that kind of art consistency, and I can appreciate where Civil War, Steve McNiven, and Marvel are coming from, but I just think that DC, within the pages of JSA, for example, Len Kirk and Don Kramer and Keith Champagne, all three of them are contributing to the book, and literally from page to page, you're getting a slight change in the art, and I don't know, maybe I'm just kind of not as much of an artist person when it comes to comics, but it didn't bother me. And the changes each week in 52 doesn't bother me as much as it does, I think, some other fans that are kind of complaining and saying, I wish this was just more of a consistent package.
Right. And, I mean, I would say that when it comes to some editorial scheduling problems, as a whole, DC usually makes a little bit more than Marvel, but when they do, they're less dramatic problems. When DC messes up, they cover their mistakes real well, and they are kind of used to that problem, maybe. Marvel doesn't screw up as much in that arena, and when it happens, it's a catastrophe. You know, I've always compared DC as a steady, strong tugboat to Marvel's, ski boat. Marvel's very fast, very edgy. They turn on a dime. When they want to do Civil War, bang, they're going to do Civil War. When they wanted to decimate the mutants, bang, they decimated the mutants. When they wanted to decimate the Avengers, they did it. They kind of shoot first and ask questions later, while DC sits back and really judges a lot of things that Marvel does, compares them to what they could do, slowly make their changes, and then adjust to the industry. That's the way I've kind of always viewed it. That hasn't been the case in every mean. You know, I think they took a nice big risk with 1 year later and with 52, and it's paying off. But it was just a little bit more of an educated, slower, calculated risk. as opposed to Marvel's bang, 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 spectacle, spectacle. It's very apparent in the way that they interact with the blossoming Hollywood fascination with comic books, because Marvel always wants to beat their movies to the punch in their storylines.
Okay.
Wolverine Origin. Origin, they wanted to do it because Hollywood was going to tell that story.
Yes. No, I agree with that.
DC Comics, they knew about Superman's son and Superman Returns, but they gave it to them. They instilled it. I don't know how much of that is logistics within a company, you know, Warner Brothers versus Marvel and Toy Biz or whatever.
Right,
But it's a definitely different philosophy in terms of how are we going to present these stories to the masses. Marvel wants to beat them and rush them out at times so that they have the canon over any Hollywood person. They kind of don't have that trust, or at least they didn't. Well, they had the right to Hulk and everything else.
They didn't have control over their movie properties because options were signed 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and I understand that. I also think that it's interesting that you make the Hollywood comparison to Marvel. I'll say that DC, you know, benefits from Dan DiDio's television background,
right,
running daytime TV for ABC, and especially in the case of 52, where it really is this idea of, you know, wow, I can't believe what just happened this week. I want to see what happens next week. And that also goes for the monthlies as well. And I think that that is their editorial dictate from DiDio in terms of, and in fact, I've heard him say it, make the monthlies matter. Make every month, you know, oh my God, I can't believe how this just ended, and now I got to wait 30 days. In the case of Civil War with Marvel, like you said, the whole line was tied into Civil War, and it was kind of semi-weekly because each week, while the main book wasn't coming out,
absolutely,
these other titles are there, and they do provide enough, as opposed to the other events, I think, in Marvel and DC's background, when they've got books tying in. I think Marvel finally achieved with Civil War what they had been trying to do for years, and that
absolutely
is give you the option of either wanting to read those tie-ins or not, and not being hurt by not reading those other, you know, add-on books, but only the story only gets enhanced in a positive way.
It's the greatest thing in the world that Civil War is the greatest crossover event of all time, and 1 year later, Slash 52 is the second greatest crossover event of all time. You know, and it's not a huge blowout landslide.
Spoken like a Marvel fan, I like that.
It's not a huge landslide. It is subtle, and if you want to look at the details of it, I mean, DC got a huge leg up. The fact that they can possibly outlast them in terms of editorial schedule with this, you know, I mean, they're going to be making a lot of cool revelations in the 1 year later books and in 52,
right,
while all of the Civil War fans are going to have to sit there and wait. So we'll see what that happens in 2, 3, 4 months' time,
right,
you know, the implications of that, and if there's going to be a big payoff for all the DC fans saying, yeah, 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 you know, Hines, you know, thinking we're all hot with Marvel. But Civil War, in my opinion, is the greatest crossover event of all time. It's going on right now, and 52 is the second. It's better than, you know, Executioner's Song. It's better than Armageddon 2000.
Certainly.
Any of that. It's these are the greatest time to be in comics.
I agree with that.
And that's why it's so much fun.
No, I absolutely agree. And I think the writers, I think the medium, and I think the writers had to reach a point of, these writers read all of those other crossovers as well. And I think there's that combination of talented writers, but also a good firm commitment from the editorial side saying, this is the direction the story is going in. Writers, you either jump on and participate, or we'll find other writers to write these books.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because I think that was the failure of past events. But also, I think, and I think you can appreciate this as a guy who's read comics for a long time, you know, 5 or 10 years from now, when the story is played out, there probably is going to be another reboot. We are going to probably start over again with some characters or some things. It's inevitable. It's been happening in comics. Jerry Siegel rewrote his Superman origin in 1949.
Well, DC can do it. DC has that contract with the fans of definite expectations. Eventually, we're going to have the JLA being in control on their watchtower again. Not so with Marvel. Marvel truly is if the Clone War doesn't work, we'll ride our way out of it. You know, we'll have Green Goblin come back, and he'll kill the clone in front of everybody, and we'll just transfer all that hate for the clone onto Green Goblin. They don't have a massive crisis. Quesada says so. There's no crises and Marvel. There's not going to be a massive reboot. If there is, it's not very Marvel-y of them.
Well, I understand.
So we might have character reboots.
I think it's fair for Quesada to say that now, I just think that the jury is still out, and let's see what happens in 5 or 10 years, because I don't think they intended for things to, you know, get painted into a corner. And I don't. And also, by the way, I don't think Civil War is going to end up in obviously any neat package. I'm sure you feel the same way. This will reverberate for, you know, probably a couple years afterwards, and that's fine. And I don't mind. I mean, that's the thing. It's for me. It's like it's. Don't you think there are so many fans that are like, yeah, this is fun now, but they're all, you know, they always look at the glass as being half empty, and it's like, well, you know, eventually it's going to, you know, reset, and that sucks. And I, you know, they're already dreading the retelling of Spider-Man's origin.
Well, all we know is that Spider-Man's getting out of that gold and red suit with the three arms sticking out of them and the spikes coming out of his wrists
and feet.
And feet. That's all we know. Like, seriously, he has so much crap coming out of his body.
I'm hip.
He is disgusting. You know, I mean, I thought it was a little bit nasty when they were going to be organic shooters in the first movie. Kind of was able to forget about it. Because that's human waste, John.
Yes,
it's human waste.
Yeah, that is icky.
And he's coming out with all this stuff. He's got to be eating so much more than Flash in the 90s TV show.
To generate that waste?
He's losing all this these calories. Something's got to happen. And then also in that McNiven shot in 3 of Civil War, I don't know. They're just showing too much of Spider-Man. That was such a horrible junk shot of Civil War 3. I don't know. I don't even want to go there with the new junk shots all over comics. But John, my point is...
you can say anything you want on this show, Scott.
That's
don't
right.
Worry, there's no FCC, so go to town if you need to.
Excellent. What were we talking about?
No, the concern or the fear. I think that preconceived notion by some readers that are just like, you know, they're going to hit the reset button eventually anyway, and they're already disappointed waiting for that day that might not come for 10 years or 7 years or whenever.
As far as I'm concerned, Iron Man and Captain America could be at different sides of the political spectrum forever. They may never rejoin as
That's
a unified Avengers again.
Yeah, no, you're right about that.
That is something I'm willing to submit as a fan so I can really enjoy the here and now.
Sure.
This is a huge risk. They're punching each other like crazy. They're hating each other more than their own little rogues gallery.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I heard you last night with Mark Millar, and it was a great show, and I really enjoyed the part where you said that you can't understand why Spider-Man would take Tony's side.
I can now after Mark explained it.
Okay, because the other thing I was just going to ask you was that don't you think that he questions that decision to go with Iron Man every moment since he's taken off his mask?
Yes.
And I love seeing that conflict within him, and I think that very much plays to the strengths of who Spider-Man is. I agree with what Mark said, too, and for people who didn't hear it, you should definitely listen to the Mark Millar interview when it comes on. But in the meantime, he said that obviously Joss Whedon told him that Spider-Man would do the right thing,
mm-hmm.
and of course would follow, obey the law. But I also think that Spider-Man doubts himself all the time and has always been an insecure guy, whether he was a teenager or an adult, and that while, yes, I think he does want to do inherently the right thing, it is part of his own self-conflict of questioning himself and saying, was this the right move?
Yes.
And the agony that he's going through having to fight Captain America.
You hit the nail on the head. It's not necessarily that he was going to do the right thing. It's that he is always going to be in the worst situation possible.
Yep.
I mean, Reginald Hudlin, when he was comparing writing the Black Panther book to the Spider-Man book, you know, Reginald Hudlin was like, all right, it's totally two ends of the spectrum.
You bet.
Black Panther is the epitome of Reginald Hudlin wanted to be. The most technologically advanced country in the world.
Self-confident.
He's the king. He is the king. He's got multiple wives. I mean, it's Black Panther. He's the best. Then Spider-Man, forget the self-loathing, forget the guilt of his uncle. He is going to be put into situations that is always going to be the worst for any character in literature. I mean, with Gwen Stacy, with, you know, him just being married and having the guilt of always going out and doing his job,
yes,
while his wife stays at home. That's never been reconciled. That's something that's always hurt them. He gets beat up and hurt more than anybody else. He's more human than anybody else. He's the one we can relate to more than anybody else. And the shtick is to pound the crap out of him, just like Millar's Marvel Knight Spider-Man.
Yes. Yes.
That was the theme of the whole thing. How can we hurt him more? You know, that's his shtick. And so by having him going against Captain America and seemingly also a lot of fandom who know and trust and love these characters and don't see how Tony Stark can kind of turn on a dime on this issue a little bit and not defend superhero community, by pitting Spider-Man with the establishment is only going to rain terror down on him more, which is exactly what happens to Spider-Man in Marvel Comics.
Yeah, well, and it's that irony of, you know, the phrase, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and I mean that's kind of what Spider-Man is going through, you know.
Right.
And I also thought too, there's a guy that always is, you know, on the front page of the Daily Bugle as a villain and a vigilante, and it's like, yeah, maybe doing this will finally get people off my back and realize I am just trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And yes, we find him in the current mess that he's in. No, and from that standpoint, I do think Civil War is great. I also love 52, and I love the characterization that's going on in 52, that I think people took Dan DiDio's words of we're going to eventually make the DC universe a brighter place. I think they took that too literally, because I also think that maybe they forgot the idea that in stories there always has to be some sort of conflict and there always have to be problems. And they're like, wow, this is supposed to be a brighter DCU. You've got Elongated Man who's half crazy out of his mind, you know, grabbing the straw dowel, you know, crying about Sue and,
right,
you know, all the things going on. I think they're making really interesting choices with the characters that I think at the end of the day, if you look inside the characters, this is what motivates these people, and all they're doing is just going through a period of conflict. I think eventually, you know, they'll be changed and some will be resolved, but I have no problem with the tough journey they're going through right now in 52.
Yeah, DC has been really dark, and 52 is kind of its own creation where it's something that is kind of now, it's 1 year later, we're reading all these Superman heroes, you know, Up, Up, and Away, and other great Superman stories that are
great
going
Superman
on now. Now 52 is kind of in the past, and so that kind of is its own animal right now. While I do see the next wave of current times DCU stories are going to have to be a little bit brighter because of the bleakness of Infinite Crisis and of Max Lord and OMAC and all the things that Batman did and the JLA did. If it kept going down that path, it would just be crazy psychotic Earth 2. You know, I mean, it would just be too much. So, I think they really want to open up the DC universe so they can invite a lot of indie creators, a lot of people that haven't been attracted to the continuity, the great, great creators, you know, the Terry Moores of the world, for him to actually possibly do a Supergirl story, or the Joseph Michael Listener, or all the great Image guys, or Mike Mignola, you know, all of the great guys that they have a huge fan bases that everybody would just die to see them do a superhero comic book. I think the deal is creating really good soil for a DC universe that won't be as heavily continuity connected, where, you know, if Wonder Woman kills a guy, it's on every single TV screen and every book. That's something I think they're going to a little bit turn away from. It's kind of been there, done that.
Well, that's interesting. I don't know. I think both companies right now are appreciating the shared universe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I understood why Marvel didn't do it for 5 years because, as they said, they were trying to redefine their characters.
Yeah.
But I think, I don't know. I think the connected story, again, I point to Dan DiDio's, this is where I'll disagree with you. I think Dan DiDio's daytime television background says, no, I think everybody likes the story and wants to know what's going to happen next, and I think they do like the fact that things are kind of interrelated. And I understand that there are going to be resolutions, that Batman is going to be more balanced and stuff, but I don't think that, you know, problems are going to go away. I do think conflict will still be there, and I think their heroes will still have flaws.
Right, you can still have an invasion from Brainiac and have the tone be a little bit lighter.
Okay.
You know, you can still have people possessing other people's minds, and you can even have, like, a lot of assault without having rape and drug use, and it doesn't have to be dark, dark stuff like we experienced the past couple years. We'll see about the interconnectedness. I personally think it's going to slow down.
That's fine.
We'll see in the next couple years. But
we're just readers, man. I mean, yeah, they're the ones calling the shots. It's just what we see.
I really love the first 10 or so issues of 52, and Jerry Ordway's, I think it was Jerry Ordway's, History of the DC Universe, and just that backup story, you know,
yeah,
was going on. And it caught me up, it reminded me of a lot of things that were going on. it kind of put things in a little cosmic point of view. And I loved Ram Thanagar War, and I want to see more stuff of that from all the creators. You know, just today, Warren Ellis sent out his bad signal saying, where's all the spaceships? You know, where is spaceship stories in comics, in TV shows, in all this stuff? I mean, we have the technology. We can do good sci-fi.
I think DC is going to address all that with bringing back Mystery in Space and Jim Starlin doing Captain Comet soon.
That's true, yeah.
That'll be cool. I also think that, now it's funny, you like the Ram Thanagarian War. I heard a lot of fans say, well, we don't know how that ended other than they saw Superman's or Superboy's handprints on the planet and they were able to figure out his involvement as far as being the bad guy in Infinite Crisis. But I think, again, I think 52 is going to answer those questions. And that's how I feel about Civil War as well. As much as when 7 ends, there'll be some sort of ending, much like Infinite Crisis had. It's, or rather, Identity Crisis had an ending, and Infinite Crisis, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
But questions were still left open, and they're periodicals. You're not going to get the end, I think, at the end of Civil War, and certainly not even at the end of 52, as much as it's going to spill into what's going on now. I guess 52 is explaining how everybody got to where they were at the start of 1 year later.
Yeah.
But it is enjoying that journey of, well, how did they get there? We still don't know what happened in that missing year.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be fun. But yeah, I kind of like these unanswered questions that will be explored in the various specific books. And I'm happy to be on the journey. And again, that's why it's like, as opposed to worrying about when things eventually do get reset and we are going to be back at Spider-Man's origin or Superman's origin, I don't care. I mean, that's years from now.
No, and they don't have to do that.
Enjoy the ride now.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many great narrative tricks you could pull. I mean, right now the world believes that Peter Parker is Spider-Man. Well, all you got to do is disprove that, you know, on a public scale. It doesn't have to be a massive mind wipe.
Or the cosmic cube.
Yeah, you could just like, you notice how we quote-unquote caught Bush saying shit, you know, how we caught him? Ooh, we're so clever for catching him saying shit. Whenever he was saying a global political statement that he wanted the world to hear, you know?
Right.
We can catch Peter Parker and Spider-Man being in the same place and have the world think that that was a great situation to spread the pro-registration message.
Oh, Danny Rand has to just, you know, switch costumes and stop being Daredevil and start being Spider-Man for a while.
They've done it all the time. they did it in the great Daredevil, when Peter Parker dressed up in Daredevil in the trial of Daredevil.
The Bob Gale story.
Which I really like.
I love that story.
In between all the great, I mean, that was the one that was kind of forgotten of this one.
I completely agree with you.
Of the rebooted Daredevil, which has just been masterwork after masterwork of creators. That one, that's great. I don't think that's been traded.
I don't think it's been collected either. I agree with you. Well, there you go, Quesada. There's two of us now. Trade the Gale story. That's a great story.
And get Gale to do more stuff. I think maybe because there wasn't the hoopla, maybe they haven't said the creator of the friggin' Back to the Future series.
You bet.
Get him to keep doing more comics. Get him to do Back to the Future comics. Talk about an infinite landscape.
Have you read American Way, the John Ridley
Wildstorm? Yeah. Oh, my God.
Isn't that awesome?
I love it.
I'm a big fan of that as well. And that's another thing, too. I think Wildstorm is really interesting. I think I always love interesting books that come out of Vertigo. I'm glad to see that Icon is adding more titles. I'm glad to know from talking to Axel Alonso that there are going to be more Max books along the way.
Yes.
And it's nice to see the experimentation happening in the satellite imprints of DC and Marvel. And I think they're doing their own experimentation within the mainstream books as well. But I think there's room for both. And it's nice to see that they're not just sitting back and just regurgitating, you know, new Batman stories and new Spider-Man stories or Wolverine stories, and that they are expanding in these other directions.
Well, from a Marvel fanboy, DC has got Marvel whipped in that arena. Whipped in the satellite publishing outlets. And that's just because they got the money of Warner Brothers.
But
Wildstorm with The Boys, with Wildcats coming out.
Yep.
The Boys was just drop dead. Wonderful read.
Yes,
I mean, a lot of it was set up, but absolutely amazing. You got Fables and Why the Last Man and Vertigo. I mean, it is just, it's heaven. It's absolutely the best reading in comics is DC Satellite. Marvel Satellite, we got Punisher. We got Powers, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just kind of waiting for more. It's not like there's any kind of history of bad stuff. I love the Howard the Duck out of Max. I love the Howard the Duck.
I did too.
Well, it was filthy and wonderful.
Well, absolutely. With Steve Gerber finally being allowed to do Howard the Duck, he's always the way he's always wanted to do it.
Yeah. I don't see why they're not. I mean, and I think it's every scale. I think it is creators, editors, and fans not being vocal enough to have more of the Marvel mentality and Marvel-exclusive creators doing non-superhero work. And we all need to work together to make that happen, because DC creators have the freedom of doing something like All-Star Superman, The Invisibles, and then something that's kind of in between. You know, Grant Morrison can really do anything and then also pump out a Seven Soldiers. While Marvel, it's like, okay, well, which Marvel character do I want to do now? If I'm signed exclusive in 2000 till 2015, make it a little bit more. I think that one of the things is DC has a huge leg up in Marvel when you just look at the facts, is that if you're signed exclusive with DC, you can kind of do a little bit more of what you want.
Well, but I think Marvel has kind of responded with Icon, and certainly Brubaker is all excited about Criminal, and well, he should be. And I think that, you know, Quesada himself says if there's one area that he would, you know, like to be more like Marvel, or rather like DC, it is with the Vertigo line. He's always been jealous of Vertigo.
Yeah.
I think that DC, with the cushion of Warner Brothers behind them as a publishing entity, can rely on the strength of their trade sales and take the losses that, you know, the Losers and those other Vertigo and Wildstorm books might have as monthlies, knowing that they will eventually find their audience in trade.
Yeah.
And I think Marvel, you know, just that's where DC as a company has a, I think, financial advantage over Marvel. But I think to Marvel's credit, I think they're trying to find other ways, recognize there's an interest in those kinds of properties, and they're trying to find avenues to allow those to be printed.
Yeah, and that's the one direction where Marvel is more trepidatious than DC, because Marvel has Stephen Colbert in the palm of their hand.
Yeah.
He would do a comic for him after all of that gushing and you know.
And only beat him to it.
Only beat him to it. Because Marvel just doesn't, because, I mean, whether it's a parody comic, like Wahan, take it forever to come out, and the slow wait for Spider-Ham, and now it's going to be, like, not really a satire kind of comedy book, possibly, from J. Michael Straczynski, They need to be a little bit more flexible on the things that they're just not used to. And I don't know. That's just coming from the passionate Marvel fan that just wants to see them beat the snot out of DC.
Oh.
I love them all. And I'm reading probably more DC books, if you want to categorize all of Wildstorm and Vertigo into DC. But
I grew up as more of a DC fan, but I think I've just reached that age where it's like, I don't care about the horse race. I don't care who's number one. I want good books. And I really agree, and I'm glad to hear Quesada and DiDio say, hey, when both of us are doing well, that means comics are doing well. And to be honest, we should really open it up and say, when Image finds its niche, when Oni is able to pop in with the books that they're able to, you know, entertain people with, that just means good product. I mean, yay for good comics, and who cares whoever's publishing them. Support the ones that you like so that they can keep coming out, and they, you know, we keep getting good entertainment. Because I agree with you, this is the best time ever. As someone who's been reading comic books for, you know, 35 years, this is the best it's ever been.
Mm-hmm. So, great time to be a fan.
You bet. Well, look, man, this has been great. I really appreciate your time, and I enjoy Fanboy Radio. And once again, that's Wednesdays at 1 p.m.
Yes, sir.
Sundays at 6 p.m. Those are central times.
Central time.
So,
the most important time. Right, John?
Well, because we live in the central time zone. It's real time, as Harry Truman used to call it when he was in the White House. He always kept his watches set at central time, and he called it real time.
That's right. Hey, I agree with Truman on that.
There you go, man. So, Scott Hines, I appreciate your time today, and I appreciate the opportunity of having a real fanboy discussion.
Oh, John, anytime, man.
Fun conversation with Scott Hines, the host of Fanboy Radio. A quick public service message. This week, the Texas home of award-winning comics writer-artist Leah Hernandez caught fire and burned. Half her house is now gone. The rest is smoke damage. Leah has two children, and right now they need a place to stay and some clothes to wear, and more than that, they need some help. If you can help in the form of donations to her PayPal account, it'd be great if you could take a moment and send whatever you can. Mail it to Diva Leah, that's D-I-V-A-L-E-A, @gmail.com. I also know that the Bendis board is setting up an auction of art to help give proceeds to Leah's cause as well. So go over to the Bendis board at jinxworld.com And if you go to the message board, there's a sticky up there with more information on that auction as it progresses. And that'll do it for this edition of WordBalloon.com. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Keep coming back to WordBalloon for more updates on upcoming episodes. WordBalloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2006.